Good afternoon, good evening, and good night. Hello. Welcome back. This is Peter Murimi. He's a documentary filmmaker who has covered many, many very interesting topics. Most notably, though, and the subject of today's podcast, is a recent film about baby snatching and human trafficking in Kenya. It's very tragic but also interesting story and an insight into this developing nation. Peter has also made documentaries and films about suicide in Kenya, as well as LGBTQ considerations. You know, what's it like to live as a gay person? Where is LGBTQ within the Kenyan culture, and how does the society accept it, and so forth? He's a really cool dude, as you will see throughout the chat. From this podcast, you can expect to learn why Kenya is called the Silicon Savannah, a little bit about the baby snatching story, and then a great sort of generalized introduction into Kenya. The links to his movies are incoming. There wasn't sort of publicly available links. So we're going to see what we can, me and Peter are discussing what we're going to be able to do about that. And so I really hope that you enjoyed this conversation with Peter. Also in this podcast description, you're going to see a link to my newsletter. So it would be really cool to get a bunch more people to sign up for that. It's sort of just like a monthly best of, you know. So through the noise, you can get fantastic podcasts and recommendations, even a bit of music, certainly a book or two. And with that, Peter Murimi.
All right. Well, Peter Murimi, thank you so much for joining me, mate. Really, really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Cheers. So I heard this story on the BBC a while ago, a couple of months ago now, about this horrific case of child snatching and sort of child trafficking in Kenya. And featured as one of the journalists on the piece was yourself, a video journalist, a videographer, a filmmaker. I'm not sure what the exact title is, but that story was just so unbelievable. It really got me quite interested in Kenya, and also sort of what could the institutions be like there to almost allow something so horrific like this to happen. Mm-hmm. So I was hoping we would be able to, well, not us, but really you'd be able to explain to us, you know, maybe Kenya, how the institutions are where they are, and how that leads to this sort of giant gaping hole where sort of child trafficking can operate. So there's that, but then I'd also like to know a lot about you. So, you know, keeping it open-ended, maybe you could just start by introducing yourself and, you know, how you got to the point where you're producing such an amazing story like that.
Okay. As introduced me, my name's Peter Murimi, and I'm a documentary director, producer, and I do current affairs ish, like Baby Stealers, which is a current affairs for broadcast, but also I do long-form documentaries on social issues. Like there's a documentary right now called I'm Samuel, which is about a gay man who is from Kenya, and it's a story about what it means to be gay and poor in Kenya, in a sense. So I'm interested in issue of governance and social issues, but also like just passionate about telling the African narrative, basically in the African way, to the rest of the world and for Africans as well.
But why Kenya? Like, what's your connection to Kenya? Because the two stories then are Kenyan based, but you're speaking to me now from London. So how does your story fit into that?
Yeah, so Kenya is home. That's where I was born. That's where I grew up, and that's where most of my connections are. And as a storyteller, you know, storytelling is about access. It's about connection. It's about relatability. Mm-hmm. And that's where I get all those things from. And in a sense, I feel as a storyteller, I get my fulfillment by telling stories from home.
Mm-hmm. And are you in the United Kingdom now because of work? Like, you started making films in Kenya, and then now as maybe an employee for the BBC, that's how it works. What in your story drew you to the United Kingdom?
Actually, it happened the other way around. Like, since 2017, I've been living in the UK, And I came here for personal reasons, for a relationship, for love. We used to live...
a love refugee.
Yeah, we used to love refugee. We used to live in Kenya, and she had to move here, and we moved here. And when I came here, connections with the BBC, and I kept on working. And so I do some work back home and keep coming back here.
But you were making videos in Kenya before you came to the UK.
Yeah, like what? I'm 43 now. I started working when I was 24. So yeah, I've been working for a long time. 20-something years experienced. Yeah.
Wow, it's amazing. So you would have, from your experience, you know, one of the best insights into Kenya, right? I mean, because journalists, their job is to try and dig into and understand how things are working in whatever their specific field is. And if you've spent the majority of your life doing exactly that in Kenya, I imagine you do have just an amazing insight into how the country operates and what its weaknesses are, what its strengths are, and stuff like that. I'd love for you to sort of, you know, teach me a little bit about Kenya. I think that would be fantastic.
Yeah, I have a love-hate relationship with Kenya, in a sense. Like, cause if you ask me, it's the best place to be in the world. Like, beautiful climate, very diverse. And there's so many places where I could say life is as should be, because like right now I'm here in the UK. I've traveled quite a bit, but it's very hard to find a place you can say that is untouched. Like, you could see in this country like traces of us human beings, like with roads, with housing, with electricity. There's nowhere you go and it's as it should be. And in Kenya we have that, you know, we have nice modern city, beautiful city, we have perfect coast, but also we have the countryside, where the zebras, elephants, giraffes, and people living side by side in complete, almost complete harmony. But at the same time, there's this dysfunction that's very frustrating, because the country that is so beautiful, that is so nice, people still need services. Healthcare sometimes is wanting, education sometimes is wanting. And we have corruption as well in the governance system. So it's a beautiful, beautiful place. But as you say, always, for someone who, I always ask more of myself, I know we deserve more in Kenya and we should rightfully get more than what we're getting right now.
Yeah. So it sounds like it's sort of the case of many developing nations around the world. Like, there is a lot of signs of progress and development. It's usually in the main capital city. Maybe it's even restricted to a couple of suburbs in that capital city, but then the rest is sort of all improvised, trying to maybe either work their way there or work their way out. I'd love, if you have insights into this, I'd love to know, like, what the population of Kenya is, what the sort of main economic rhythms are, you know, what are you exporting, what are you importing, and potentially whether there's a big brain drain there or not. I just know from personal experience, I've met Kenyans all around the world, and it's obviously a huge population, but is it also the case that a lot of Kenyans are trying to leave Kenya rather than stay there themselves? But do you have insight into those things I just said?
Yeah, no, the thing is, Kenya, it's thriving. And yes, there's quite a few Kenyans who have left for greener pastures, and rightfully so. But also, there's still fantastic people and amazing and very talented, skilled people in Kenya. And I know for a while also there was like that reverse, that people who had left so many years to go to the States, to go to Europe or sometimes in Canada, but came back. Because sometimes, because of where Kenya is right now, like, the opportunities are much more, because here it's you could say like it's a developed economy. There's so many people doing exactly the same thing. There's saturation in most skills. But in Kenya, with the right skills, actually you'll thrive more than here.
Yeah.
And I've seen that that happen. But it's a place where also you have to be very innovative, you have to be agile, and also resilient. And if you're all that, you can thrive. And I've seen, and I know people who are thriving, and doing really well. And it has, it can give you back so much more than you give. And it's not just Kenya. I would say it's something in the developing world. There is a big difference than what you get from here. Because in a sense, is that also freedom? Because here, because everything is really regulated, very rigid, and sometimes very little room for maneuver. Because for you to survive, you know, with the mortgage and the tax, the things you have to pay, sometimes you can get locked to a situation or a job or a career, and it's really hard for you to change midstream.
Mm-hmm.
But in Kenya, it can give you that.
But what about population size and the economic situation?
So it's one of those things. I think it's a problem. I could say at independence in 1963, we were 12 million. Mm-hmm. Now we're approaching 60 million.
Wow, massive increase. Did you say 12 million to 60 million?
Yeah.
But is that because of a failure in counting the first time around?
No.
Or it is simply the case that they've 5x their growth?
No, the thing is, healthcare has been improving.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, back then, because there was very little hospital, most mothers are giving birth at home, the mortality rate was really high.
Yeah.
Almost like half sometimes. But now it's almost a guarantee, every child who's born survives.
Yeah.
So that that affected the situation. But also, especially in the villages, and rightly so, back then, it was more advantageous to have many children because to help out with subsistence farmers.
Mm-hmm.
So the more children you have, the more hands you have to help you in the farm. And so that mentality still exists with improved healthcare, so people are living longer. So the population is exploding.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, it is. So it depends who you ask. If you ask me, I think it's an issue. But sometimes people point to, to China, the numbers turn them into a powerhouse because of the sheer numbers, it was cheap labor.
Mm.
And
yeah,
so,
that's a bit of a fragile argument, though, isn't it? I mean, China enforced a demographic restriction on how many kids you could have for 40 years or something. There's a lot more factors to China's success rather than just having a lot of people around.
I know. And that's the thing, there are politicians or policymakers right now who don't discourage, actually, and especially because of the politics, because it's tribal. If you're a politician, you'd want your tribe to keep pumping up the numbers because we vote in blocks. And so that's also an issue that's driving it up because the policymakers or the politicians are encouraging their tribes to give birth more, to have a bigger political block.
So 60 million people. And most of the people are in Nairobi. Do you know how big Nairobi is? I'm just trying to, what I'm trying to do
no,
here is
no,
I'm
most...
trying to paint a geographic picture. So we've got here where Kenya is, it's in the middle of Africa, so it's almost there on the equator, which I believe is running just through there. And, like you said, you're on the coast, but you've got Somalia as neighbors, some would say a failed state, Tanzania just to the south, another very poor country. I mean, from a geographic perspective, it's a place where much productivity has been very hard to grow, right? Which is the story for many African nations. And so I'm trying to understand the geography.
Actually, so the equator goes right in the middle of Kenya. And what's interesting is if you split Kenya into two, you draw a straight line, the top half of it is semi-arid to desert, which goes up to Somalia. That side is to Ethiopia. It's very dry.
Mm.
And it's sparsely populated. People who live there are mostly pastoralists, basically, with the camels or cows and goats, and they move around for pastures. The majority of the people in Kenya live in the bottom half. I think almost 80% of the population.
Interesting, okay.
So where Mount Kenya is, which is around halfway through, that's where it's the most productive land. Like, it's a highland. It's very green. There's tea, which I think we have the best tea in the world.
Nice.
Like,
even other bias there, I'm sure.
No, actually, really, as a fact, like, our tea is the most expensive tea.
As in a fact, okay.
Yeah, no, it's true. Like, our tea is the best. And what they do, they get tea from India and China, mm-hmm. and blend it with ours to lift the grade. But our tea is one of the best in the world.
Okay, but do you want to say more about the split in the demography, what it means for the bottom 80%?
Yeah, so majority live in the second half. And what has been happening in the years, there's some really productive places where, because of people are living on it, land that used to be agricultural land is becoming smaller and smaller and smaller. So in the future, that's going to be an issue. At the moment, we just about making it, like, in terms of feeding ourselves, with the exception of if there is a drought, but also there's a system now that we can buy food from our neighbors, like from Tanzania, from Uganda.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it sort of works. So I think it'll be a problem in the future. And all this, I could be wrong. This is my theory, because sure, if the population continues to grow at this rate, that land that is supposed to be agricultural is going to be land that people are living on.
Mm-hmm.
So the food has to come from somewhere else. And maybe we'll stop being, because right now agriculture is the main activity, like it's the biggest economic earner.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll have to modify how our economy works and change it to something else.
Okay. And is there any sort of like English hangover that you feel as a Kenyan or as someone living in Kenya? Is there, like, for instance, is there still much of an affinity to the United Kingdom, or is it sort of just like unacknowledged or unrecognized?
Have you been to Africa before?
No. Morocco. Yes, sorry. Morocco. Forgive me. But not,
Africa.
Not south.
It's very interesting. As you say, like, the two big blocks is the Francophone Africa and the Anglophone Africa. So the Africa that was colonized by the French, the French thinking, and also like they have these French influences.
Mm-hmm.
And same as, like, especially in Kenya, like you can see traces of colonization, like with English. But I don't think there's that affinity. We, at the moment, trying to break away, but obviously we have English system, and in entertainment there's some cultural issues that there, like we love our tea a lot, like English do, but it is not that occupies our brain like we're very close to England. Not really. It's I could say it's also those chapters need to be closed, but it's difficult to close because also our fight for independence was very bitter because it was very violent on both sides. And I think, like, the British, I think until recently, paid a big settlement for the abuses they did to the freedom fighters. Yeah, no, it's those unsaid things. I think we've moved on, but not really moved on. And we keep on saying we are close. Diplomatically, you say we are close. But yeah, we're trying to figure our own path.
Interesting. Yeah. You know, for me, the reason why I'm inquiring maybe too much is just because I'm trying to learn as much as I can about sort of, you know, the nations of the different guests that get to come onto the podcast, you know. So, like, for example, my knowledge of Kenya is, yeah, absolutely nothing. And it's just interesting to learn a little bit to try and figure out maybe how it's operating. Something you said there before, how if you have the right skills and mindset, Kenya can be an amazing place for you to be in from an entrepreneurial perspective. That really resonated with me quite a lot. I was recently in Mexico, a country which is developing for sure, but absolutely has a lot of developed parts in it. But in terms of the institutions, they're very developing. You know, like there is a lot of leeway for corruption and also a lot of ways to circumvent bureaucracy. And because of that, you know, like when I was in Mexico, I was thinking this is, you know, a hotbed of opportunity if you just have, say, a touch of capital and then the right ideas and the right sort of like mindset. And it's interesting you say that. I imagine it's similar in Kenya, according to what you said.
No, it is. And there's something I like about Kenya, like, okay, having lived in the UK, and I can see the difference. Mm-hmm. Like sometimes here people tend to depend so much on the state and not themselves.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes that limits you in a sense. But in Kenya, or I could say many developing countries, basically, you know, whatever you achieve, whatever you earn, or whatever you make, or living or surviving or not surviving, is up to yourself.
Mm.
So it gives you this other drive
mm-hmm.
and hunger, but also independence at the same time.
Yeah, totally. And if you have that urge to like make yourself financially secure, you know, as it were, in Mexico or in Kenya or in Peru, you know, you might accidentally stumble into something that does a lot more than just financially secure you. You know, it becomes a product which your entire nation all of a sudden wants to consume and you can sell, and because there's no one else there that was doing it before. So very interesting. Well, Peter, can you now explain to me and the audience this horrific story that you covered of the child snatching in Kenya? And I want to keep it open. So you just, from where you think the story should begin, could you let us, could you teach us about what is happening down there in Kenya?
So it's a classic example where one thing leads to another. And I work closely with this journalist in Kenya who works for Ghetto Radio. And she was telling me like a lot of mothers who are homeless were complaining that their children are missing. And it became like a pattern frequently, and it looked like it was organized and someone was deliberately stealing their children. And so it's one of those investigations that started with a problem. And because they were homeless, nobody was looking into it that seriously.
Sure.
And the authorities are not taking it seriously. And sometimes, you know, there are stereotypes, like you must have been drunk and just not responsible enough. That's why your child was missing. So we decided to look into it. And the more we talked to them, and it became very apparent and clear that this is something that someone should do something about.
So explain to us, where are you in Kenya? And what was that drive for you to decide, let's look into this further, because something is a little bit fishy here?
No, so as especially for me, it's become really important to give voice to the voiceless, and stories that attract me, like when I'm trying to do a story. I'm not interested in doing a story about the powerful and the mighty, famous and rich. For me, is to bring an issue or an opportunity or a problem, to highlight it, someone who everyone is ignoring.
Yeah.
And especially somewhere like Kenya, where there are so many people who need their voice heard and it's never heard. So when these homeless mothers were complaining that the children are missing, for me personally, it was very important
mm-hmm.
to highlight that and the biggest platform that I could, and in this case, BBC. And hopefully now the authorities, people responsible can pay attention. So for me, it started with that, like nobody else, if I don't do it, I don't think anybody else would take them seriously. So that's when we said, okay, let's start. And what we did is slowly narrowed it down to who we suspected could be doing it. And then we were lucky enough to have a whistleblower who knew the person. And so we sort of groomed the criminal to think that we have someone who wants to join the business. Mm-hmm. And that's how we exposed the person, Anita, who was snatching children from homeless mothers. Mm-hmm. But when we started doing that, as you know, like as an investigative story, you put your word out to your contacts, like I'm looking into this story. So information started coming to us about the hospital. And we found a whistleblower who said, yes, this is a big problem, which is disgusting to me, and I'd like to help expose it. So that's how the hospital storyline came in. Someone approached us when we were putting our word out that we want to cover this story. Do you have any information to tell us?
And the hospital storyline is that not only were the children of homeless mothers being snatched, in the hospital, newlyborns were being snatched as well.
Mm. So in the hospital, which is really unfortunate, like in the case that we documented, it was an abandoned child. And generally what the law says is this child should go to a care home, mm-hmm. where they'll be taken care of, and with time they'll be adopted legally to the chosen parents. Mm-hmm. But some people, because adoption takes in Kenya, I think 1.5 years to 2 years, some people who want to adopt find that too long and find back channels of adopting quicker. And they go to this hospital. This is a social worker. I was like, is there a child that I can adopt? And the guy was like, yeah, give me $3,000 and I'll get you a child. And we demonstrated that because he gave us a child that was abandoned,
yeah,
for the investigation. So we proved the point, which to me, because, you know, the social worker didn't do any due diligence. He didn't know who we are. He had no idea if our intentions were good with this child. We could have been the worst people in this world, and this child could end up in the wrong hands and get harmed or even dead. Mm-hmm. So what he was doing is very wrong and risky in terms of the interest of the child or children.
And what about the reasons? So did you uncover why, for what purposes these babies are being stolen?
What we know, like in this, in Kenya especially, it's very important to have a child, like to continue the family line. So for women who are barren, who can't conceive for one reason or the other, they're in absolute pressure to have a child. So sometimes it is much more easier to scheme, especially if you're living away from the village. You could easily create a story that you're pregnant, give birth, and when you go back to the villages, you can like, yeah, this is my child. So I know admitting as a woman that you can't conceive is very difficult. Mm-hmm. So women decide to come up with the biggest scheme and lie that they gave birth to a child, but they actually bought the child.
Yeah. It's interesting that that was the sort of incentive for it happening in the first place, because when I heard the story, I assumed really the worst, that it was children to be taken to then be sort of sold, whether it's whatever trafficking purpose that is going to be, whether it's like in China where it was just Westerners adopting Chinese babies who were taken from their parents, or whether it was, say, in Portugal where young kids were being snatched to then be used as victims of pedophilia and other things like that. So I was surprised to hear that it was like for a cultural reason. It was almost like a very cheap form of adoption. Obviously it's an illegal adoption, but it's like the alternative to whatever the expensive form of adoption was, and that was the motivating factor.
Yes, that was it. But the problem is, as you know, with any adoption, like it's really important for due diligence to be done, because you can't just be buying babies from the market like you buy shoes or a good. And I think the biggest problem with this situation, this guy didn't care about the child's welfare all he cared about was money in his pockets.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously quite horrible, right? But did you get any insight into the numbers? Like, how many children have been affected by this?
No, so as you know, like, it's completely secretive crime. And it was even a miracle we had the access that we did. So we've had stories of children missing, we've had stories of children who have been bought, but to have numbers is very hard to prove. We just know that it happens, and we prove that it happened and how. And the hope with us when we did the film was those loopholes that existed, that the people responsible could sort of block them, so that at least it becomes impossible or very difficult to have child trafficking in the way that we saw in Kenya happen for future children.
Do you think this is happening elsewhere?
Yeah, I'm sure. Like, it's a global problem. I think child trafficking is a global problem. And sadly, us as human beings, we have this evil side in us. And it's not just in Kenya. And in Kenya, it happened in the way that we demonstrated, but it manifests differently. I'm sure in China it happens. It happens in the States. It's happened in the UK.
Yeah.
Like, trafficking is a universal problem.
What did you learn about child trafficking by covering this story?
I think, the saddest part was sometimes we as grown-ups, we lose the bigger picture, and we think more about ourselves and never think about the point of view of the child. And that is the saddest part for me in this, because every person involved in the trafficking never thought about the welfare of the child. And it's so sad, like some of the children that went missing, I could never know who their mother is. And to me, that was really like heartbreaking. And also the mothers who would cry until they die.
Yeah.
Because they have no clue where the child is.
Yeah, I think that's the hardest, the most heart-wrenching part for me. It's like the mother's child has been taken. You know, and if a child is raised by another person, of course there's a lot of trauma there. But it's at least not like from the mother's perspective having the child taken, you know. And what about the reaction to the story? So it's been published for a while now. You know, are you receiving more information from Kenya and getting perhaps further digging deeper into the whole organizations that run these sort of things? What's happening there?
So when the story aired, especially the hospital, they shook things up. They arrested the guy that we exposed, and the case is still in court as we speak. I think, especially in that hospital, it's much more difficult to traffic a child anymore because they are more alert. And the hospital were very embarrassed that this was happening in the institution.
Yeah.
I think mothers, homeless mothers, were more aware and alert because we sort of exposed how it's done. But it's really sad. I think 2 days ago, I think Monday, the headline in the paper was, there's an uprising kidnapping. And that was, to me, it's like we're back in the same place, nothing has changed. And this is a sad thing. You know, sometimes as filmmakers, we think we can change the world. Our stories will like change the world.
Make a difference, yeah.
Yeah, sometimes we're humiliated, like we realize. Find the headline. It was very sad. Oh, yeah, so it was alarm of a rise in child kidnappings in Nairobi. In the past few months, there have been growing appeals on social media about missing family members. Yeah, so it's still a problem, and that's sad. The story we did apparently hasn't made a difference. Yeah, so that's depressing. That's depressing. Children are still missing. They're being stolen, kidnapped. Anyway, that's life. We can only do what we can.
Yeah, exactly. But I think bringing loads and loads of attention to it through the BBC is an amazing thing to do. Absolutely amazing thing to do. There is absolutely no doubt that your story and the people that worked on it saved at least a number of children's lives, right?
No, for sure. 100%. I'm sure about that. It's like the hospital, they've completely tightened things up. I'm sure children who have been trafficked are no longer being trafficked. So I think it worked in some level, but you know, we as filmmakers, we're idealistic. Like if I remember even when we were talking and when we were making the film, we were like, yes, we'll highlight this issue, this problem will be over. Mm-hmm. But sometimes you have to be humble and admit, yes, sometimes we can make the difference, but most of the time we make a difference, but it's not as big as we think.
You might not have changed the world, but you at least saved a few lives. And that's pretty fucking good, I would say.
yeah, true.
Yeah. All right. Well, what else is there about that story that's worth talking about?
No, I just think the important thing about that story was the mothers who had lost their children. Like, we sort of gave the issue the attention that it deserved. Mm-hmm. And at least they felt they have done. Sometimes, you know, as when you've lost your child, you're like, maybe I didn't do enough. Maybe I should have done a bit more. And to me, I think the satisfaction that they had, like, okay, even we highlighted this story in the biggest platform that we could. Mm-hmm. I think we've done as much as we can. And if we find our child, so be it. If we don't, I know I tried everything I could.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important. On a personal level, sometimes it's not about how the public consumes the film, but it's about the people in your film. Like, all of them have to feel at peace and happy with being part of it. And I'm happy about that.
Yeah. Is it the most publicized and the best piece you've ever worked on, you think?
Not really. Like, I've been around for a while, and every film is different. But if you're to ask me, there's another film I did about mental health, about suicide and with men, masculinity issues.
In Kenya as well?
Yeah. And I like that story, partly also because I really connected with it, because it's the same pressure all men go through. Mm-hmm. It's called Suicide Stories. You should watch it.
Put links to all your videos in the description.
Yeah, no, it's very powerful. And I'll tell you quickly what this story is about.
Yeah, please.
So in central Kenya, right next to Mount Kenya, and I was reading the paper, you know, in Kenya they break it down into regions sometimes, and it became like almost every day there's a story about a man who had taken their lives. And I became interested because, first of all, almost all of them were men. Mm-hmm. And it was happening in this one region. And I decided to go and look into the issue. And that place was struggling economically. And what happened, you know, like if you're in a patriarchal setting, like you're told, like, a man, you're the provider in a sense. So there's so many men who could not provide for their families. Mm-hmm. And they're feeling like they're not complete, that they're failures because they can't provide. And sometimes the women are, because it's funny how women were a bit more agile, they could adapt more. So when something fails, they could easily find a plan B, C. So sometimes the women are bringing in and supporting the family more than the men. Mm. And the men are like, I'm failing. Even my wife now is a provider and I can't. So they are just ending up leading to alcoholism, eventually taking their lives. And this is a story about this issue rather than, and it's about hopefully highlighting patriarchy is also negative. You know, sometimes we, living in a patriarchal setting, we embrace it, especially for men. Like, how do you just give away your power, in a sense? Sometimes you're like, maybe if women want it, they should come and take it. But this is one place where he's saying, look, Actually, patriarchy is detrimental to, it's not matching the current life. Because I can understand in 100 years ago how patriarchy worked. I could understand it. Because then men were hunters or gatherers were herding the cows. It was very physical. So back then, they would be like, all the men, you go fight, protect the tribe, go hunt, go gather, go do all those physical things and provide for the family. I could understand that system 100 years ago. But now the world has changed. It's outdated and we should change. And because they're not changing, it's completely messing with us as men and we're taking our lives. We're getting depressed. So this was a film looking at how basically toxic masculinity has affected mental health, leading to suicide.
I actually completely agree with what you just said about the patriarchy necessarily having changed, because it's not the case anymore that the one variable which requires a man to provide for his family is his physical strength. You know, we live in an intellectual world. You know, most people are knowledge workers or they're in some sort of administrative role to feed an eventual knowledge worker. So, I think actually the exact same as you. And I'm here in Sweden right now, which is a country that has understood this for quite a while. And there is no stigma at all in a relationship between who actually makes more money. And I've seen it firsthand in several different places. And it surprises me. In Australia, it's still the case that, like, the man should be the one that is providing for his family. And, you know, a lot of women are smarter than men. So I feel bad for for some women who are in a relationship or in a marriage with a guy, and she's much smarter than he is. So she has much more capacity to earn more money than he does. Yet there is still that sort of like traditional idea of how a house should be set up, where rather than the dad taking care of the house and kids and the mum working, it's like it's obviously a controversial thing, and it's an unnatural thing for people to think about. But when you think about it that way, the only reason that those traditional roles exist is because of a male physicality. As soon as you take away the necessity to be physical in the modern economy, then that entire structure breaks away, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I did.
And I imagine in countries like Kenya, I know, I really know nothing anecdotally or firsthand about Africa, but Mexico, a country I know quite well, that's also developing. Very machismo culture, right? Like it's the same idea that the man provides for the house and the woman never needs to do anything except look after the kids and perhaps clean, right? That's like that's the idea of it. And one of my mates, particularly, he's got a girlfriend who works, and she's very smart. She works as a credit risk analyst at a bank, right? But when we were there, we were all hanging out, all of the guys are, you know, making fun of Miguel because of his girlfriend. And, you know, it's obviously in good jest. Everyone gets it. We're all friends. No one's actually trying to make anyone feel bad. But that, even the fact that that can be happening is an idea that, yeah, I understand where if you come from a culture where that's still ingrained, why it would be extremely depressing and it would lead to suicide. You know, so what about suicide more generally in Africa? Because there is this narrative that in developing countries, suicide rates are less than they are in the developed world. As you know, Sweden, Norway, Iceland per capita are the highest suicide rated countries in the world. And they're also the most sort of prosperous or whatever. Do you have any insight into that? Maybe you can just say in Kenya, but maybe Africa-wide. Is suicide a big problem in Africa?
I think it's a problem, but I guess not as big as even I've seen here in Europe. Because partly also the thing that we have in Africa is very strong social support. Like it's very difficult for you to be absolutely alone in that sense. So I think because of that, it really like mitigates someone getting to absolutely last end of the road. Like, yes, there is depression, there's all that, but because there's always people around you, and people tend to, they easily intervene even without you you asking for help, because people check on each other like much more frequently. Mm-hmm. So I've seen that is the difference, because I know even for me, which shocked me coming here, for you to see someone, you have to call, book a, or email, and you have to agree and say, I'm free in 3 weeks' time, all that. But in Kenya, my cousin will just be walking, this guy's there. I see someone knocks on my door and just comes in. Like, how are you? What are you doing? And then they're like, oh, I have this. And they're like, okay, you finish what you're doing. I'm waiting for you. Or like, you're going to meet your friend. I'm coming along. We'll go together. Mm. So like, there's much more people get in touch.
Yeah, yeah.
Easily, and they don't have to ask for permission. And even for me, it was a culture shock. Here, to organize a meetup, you have to call and email, and people look calendars, and it can take 1 month.
whereas back home, it's sort of just like, come here now. Everyone's there.
Yeah, yeah. You know, someone will call you like, where are you? What are you doing?
Yeah.
And like I say, I'm with Ryan. We're having a chat. He's like, okay, I'm coming.
Yeah.
And then he'll come, and if we're like, okay, we are finishing. He's like, okay, I'll wait for you.
Then he brought, three of his friends?
Yeah, with three of his friends. And so, but there's, because of that, I think it's very difficult for you to get to the absolute end of the road until you take your life. People do it. Mm-hmm. But I think many people, the intervention comes much quicker.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good insight. But when you made this film, you were reporting and meeting people who had come to the end of the road and taken their life. Is that still happening as well?
Yeah, no. This place is an anomaly. The problem is universal, and it happens, as I told you, the toxic masculinity, I think, happens everywhere. But in this particular place, it was a bit exaggerated. We don't know why. Even to this day, like, that area has very high suicide rates. So the cause of it is universal, but the rate is much higher in this particular region, and that is still a puzzle that needs to be solved.
Mm-hmm.
Kenya is also called the Silicon Savannah, in a sense.
Really? Okay.
And, it is way ahead, basically, of the world in some other aspects. Like, for example, in mobile banking, I think Kenya is the leader in the world.
Wow.
And there's an app called M-Pesa, in a sense, which you can pay. You don't need a bank account. And you should look into it. Like, it's a very interesting concept, that almost all the transactions in Kenya now are done with a phone.
Mm-hmm.
And this has happened way before. Right now, I guess, with Apple Pay and Google Pay. Before that, people in Kenya were doing transactions on the phone. And I would pay you, like, your phone is like a bank account. And all I need, if I need to send money to you, I just need your number. And I just send money to you.
Amazing. See, that's what I was talking about. Like, what's the, with the economy, what's something amazing about Kenya? So it's called the Silicon Savannah. I like that. Are there any other big industries there? Like, are there big education, like, are there big universities? Is there a lot of like foreign students that come there? Is there a big tourism sector? What are your natural resources? Like, what does the economy of Kenya look like right now?
So Kenya is big on tourism, but because of COVID, that's taking a pause. Tourism is...
Can you surf on your coast?
Yeah, not like South Africa. No, you can't surf, but the beaches are actually one of the best.
Yeah.
Just have a look. Like, it's really nice. And they do, even like in Kenya, like, it's the high-end tourism, mostly, like, yeah, there's ever medium, but a lot of wealthy Europeans come to Kenya because it's one of those, it's very exclusive. And you have the Masai Mara, but also you have the coast, which is very nice.
Yeah, yeah. So, and you have the game parks and stuff, right?
Yeah, the game parks and are like world beating. It's really nice.
Yeah.
Really nice, yeah.
And there's a lot of poaching that happens in Kenya as well, right?
There is poaching, but I can't say a lot. I think even they've done a good job because overall, when you look at the population of the endangered species, elephants, it's been increasing, not decreasing.
Okay, fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah, like rhinos, it's one which was almost wiped out. So that's steady, but it's increasing like really slowly. But yes, there's a poaching problem, but I think overall that place, the country's got it right, the government.
Yeah.
And the thing is, if you look at with Somalia and like the neighbors we have, and some of the poaching, they were stealing and then taking the tusks into Somalia.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're doing a good job.
Mm. All right. Well, look, Peter, I think we're coming towards the end of our time, but I really appreciate you coming on and explaining a little bit about Kenya to us and also some of the stories that you've covered. What are you working on now?
Oh gosh, I normally, I'm scared of saying what I'm working on. I feel like I can jinx it. You know, it's like, I don't know, when you're pregnant, before you, like you will have to wait until you're sure the child will be born.
Uh-huh.
So when I'm in the edit is when I feel like I can speak about it, because right now it's still in the work process.
Okay.
And as you know, because it's an investigation.
You don't want to give anything away. That's cool. I get it.
If I give anything away, people will know about it.
Nice.
But what I'm saying, you should watch the film I did, I'm Samuel, about the gay man in Kenya. You can watch it on, I think you can buy it from YouTube. It's a really good story.
Nice. I'll link to all three of them in the description. The suicide story, the child trafficking story, and then of course, I'm Samuel.
Okay.
Amazing. Okay. Right, Peter. Thanks so much, mate. Speak to you soon.
Thank you very much for having me.